Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our 15th webinar in the Perspectives by Air Insight series. Today's topic is the post-COVID airliner cabin. We'll have an opportunity to hear expert perspectives on the airline cabins. I don't think we updated this one from last week, but we're talking about the impact of COVID on the aircraft interiors this week. Give you an opportunity to ask questions of our panel and promote discussion about really the future of what cabins are going to look like as we emerge from COVID and whether we see many changes or not and what's going to happen to our great experience. Today's panel, we have John Walton as we... The man with purple hair that's no longer purple given the COVID crisis.
Yeah, and, the COVID chop happened. Yeah,
exactly. It makes it tough. So the purple people eater is no longer purple. John is an award-winning freelance journalist and analyst. He's covered the airline industry, aviation, safety, multimodes, but primarily the passenger experience. And he's an expert in aircraft interiors, knows exactly what's going on. And John is one of the nicest guys in the industry and available for commissions and white papers and analysis. So if you want to get some real thought leadership on where things are going, John's available. We've also got Seth Miller. And Seth has a lot of experience in covering the industry. He's got a strong focus on the passenger experience and the baggage experience, judging by his photograph. He's got deep knowledge of in-flight connectivity and loyalty programs, and he's widely respected in the industry. And he... tends to consult with airlines and technology providers on innovations in the passenger experience, so that's appropriate for this COVID period. And Seth can be read at packx.aero. So today we'll have a number of issues, and I'll have Addison kick off the panel and see who wants to go first.
Oh, throw me into the lion's den with these two. Okay, so gentlemen, there is this argument that airlines, change is not something that comes well to them. And the way airplanes are today is the way they were designed to provide service in our previous life through the end of February. But now we have this whole new world of craziness. Is there going to be fundamental change in cabins? Or is there no fundamental change?
Spoiler alert, as we wrote the slide, it says no fundamental change. So yeah, I think you have a basic understanding of what our point is there. That's not to say, of course, that there's not going to be any changes at all. I think that the experience though fundamentally can't change that drastically and still have an aviation industry. I mean, we're still going to see 737s and A320s with 33 economy configurations. We're going to see 787s with 333. We're going to see A350s with 333, 343, right? Business class is still going to exist in the way that it does. How airlines sell it may differ, but fundamentally, those seats are pretty much going to be the same seats. Seth, I'm not sure what your take is on the situation with these assorted shrouds, yeah. Headrests, umbrellas, yeah. Assorted whatnots,
clips and whiz bangs and dividers. You know, I think it's sort of telling. You could say that nothing has changed and yet everything is different, in a way. And so the entire sort of in-flight passenger experience right now, with the exception of a few blocked middle seats on some airlines, very little has changed. But to many passengers, everything feels different. And just this morning, Delta CEO Ed Bastian was giving their quarterly earnings report, describing the billions and billions of dollars that they no longer have. But one of the sort of good things that he mentioned, sort of the bright spots, was that passengers, when they do come back, are feeling that because of the sort of steps the airlines are taking, that things are better than they were before. They feel a little safer. They feel a little like the airplane's a little cleaner, which, you know, it is now. But, you know, so that there's sort of some comfort there, but it's still putting, like you said, John, putting all those seats on the plane, putting all as many people as they can in those seats. Again, short term, not every airline is filling all the seats, but long term, they're going to. They have to, right? The alternate is, if you think about it, like, wouldn't it be great if we had 2-2 seating on every 737 and A320 and still could buy $79 tickets to Orlando to go see grandma? So sadly, unfortunately, the numbers don't add up on that.
No, exactly. And I think that's fundamentally where the both of us land. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I will say I like a lot of these sort of creative things that we've seen, you know, the shrouds and such, as you say. Some of the dividers, some of the sort of different ways to split up a 3-3 cabin, I think are really neat. I think there's some value in some of them. None of them are going to fly this year. None of them are going to probably fly next year. But, you know, when we start talking about what does Eurobiz look like in the future, right? Today, it's a blocked middle seat with sort of the flip down tray that sits in the middle for an extra little table. Does that change to something with a bit more privacy? Does it change to, you know, it's, you got to weigh the balance, you know, the weight issue of those things, carrying the extra stuff around. But there certainly is an argument to be made that some of these new designs are more flexible and more valuable to the people buying those premium seats in a way that could justify airlines potentially investing in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that some of these emergency measures that we've been talking about are really interesting to me, right? I think that a lot of airlines have for some time tried to dipping their toes in the water of offering extra space. You know, I know that, look, I am built for comfort, not for speed, and I'm 6'3 or 1.90 meters. So your basic economy class is not my friend, but at the same time, there are airlines which allow you to select or purchase an extra seat, whether that's for you or to share. And that's got very interesting. Now, Frontier, of course, had a bit of a misstart with that. I don't think that we're going to be able to sell it as a safety seat. I think that's a no-go. But if airlines are smart about what they sell, I mean, there are airlines certainly around the Asian region. I mean, Peach, which is the ANA low-cost carrier, sells them for the equivalent of $20 on domestic flights and 30 on international flights. And look, when you're at 29 inches on a non-slim line, I am not sized at your average Japanese person's height. So I certainly appreciate that.
Yeah, and you know, I think I will agree with you, Frontier had a misstep in the merchandising of it. But most U.S. carriers, I would argue, have had the ability to buy extra seats for a long time. I actually had a conversation with someone the other day asking about, you know, they want to go to Ireland. Their daughter is studying abroad there and they're going to go visit and this and that. And how can I make sure that I pick an airline that's going to have the middle seat blocked? And my response was easy, buy the seat. Especially at this point when fares are low enough, the comfort factor for a couple buying that middle seat, you know, pay three for two seats is huge value both for comfort and the implied safety that comes with it. But, you know, I think there is a challenge of how are you marketing it? And is it a new thing that you're selling versus just something that's always been there that people are more keen to take advantage of now?
Right, exactly. And while you have always been able to do it, on most airlines, it is a right royal faff, as we might say. It is, you know, it's complicated. It's not so simple as sort of ticking a box and saying yes. But it is, having said that, something that I do when I buy tickets for my elderly parents, right? My parents are in their late 70s and they have artificial knees and are, you know, prone to breaking their arms on holidays, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, when they're flying around bits of the world where there's no reasonable business class, Europe, I'll put them in, you know, they get in the economy and they get a middle seat and a couple of bottles of wine to dull the pain, you know. I think that fundamentally we're going to see this as a way for airlines to look at how they can merchandise their existing product a little more thoughtfully and a little more carefully.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I will say I do expect to see a few more changes in the terminal relative to the aircraft. There's not always space for it, but a little more space, a little more flexibility to work some things with, you know, depending on where and how and the time, you know, when the terminal was built. I mean, I was talking with someone yesterday about, you know, LaGuardia and the Central Terminal building, which fortunately is on its way out, but you've got, you know, airports, Terminal 1 at O'Hare is another good example. You had terminals that were designed for 727s with 120 people on them. And now you're in 60%, 70% load factors. And now you're putting 180 seat 737-800 at that gate with, you know, 85% load factor. That doesn't work in the social distancing era. And so, you know, how do you fix that? And you can't knock down all the walls and, you know, build everything out because, you know, that's even harder to do than changing the seating on an airplane in a lot of ways. So
precisely. We have a similar situation here, of course, in Europe with a lot of the terminals, the low-cost carrier terminals are essentially glorified sheds.
Yeah.
And they are, to be kind, high density. They do not, there's no way that you can fit your 186 people on an A320 in whatever 186 times 2 meters is, 390, whatever it is, right? Yeah, so.
Time on that question. I think
we're halfway through the second already. Yes.
I think that we got the message that you do not see much by way of change. Ernie, your witnesses.
I think the whole experience of travel is going to be interesting from getting to the airport, into the airport, through the airport, onto the plane, in the plane, and then back off at baggage claim, where we probably, that's where I've never been able to social distance because as soon as the first bag comes off, it's like a rush of people to that one area to catch the first bag falling down the ramp. And then exiting the airport as well. So perhaps you guys could give your thoughts on what the whole experience is going to look like starting on getting to the airport and what changes we need to make.
Yeah, I mean, if you start off with you know, public transport or being dropped off in a kiss and ride section, I think that's just going to be like the rest of life, right? There's going to be a point at which public transportation providers are simply going to stop blocking off extra seats. People are going to, you know, mask wearing is going to, you know, become increasingly mandatory. And there you go, right? Like, we are just going to have to come to terms with the fact that this disease is going to be out there for a while until we have a vaccine and or a cure. And that, you know, we're going to have to mask up and take as whatever precautions we can if we still want to operate in the world. And there will be people who choose not to operate like that, right?
Yeah. I think there's an interesting context. I was chatting with someone recently about the idea that if you go back 12 months ago, we were talking about how important it was to increase throughput through the airports to speed the entire process, security, bag claim, all these things we're talking about, because the total number of passengers was going to double in the next 10 years and we weren't building any bigger airports and everything was going to be full and too crowded and we couldn't handle it. And now for very, very, very different reasons, we have the same challenge. We have to get people in and out without touching anything, without being so close to each other. The volume of people we have to push through an airport in the same amount of time has, you know, is changing dramatically, that ratio. And so, you know, does it mean higher reliance on biometrics? Does it mean distributing bag check out into the car park rather than only in the terminal? Do we bring back the sky cap counters because that's outdoors and those are, you know, less likely to see contagion happening? A lot of things like that suddenly come back into the picture. And, you know, if you can fill out your immigration form on the companion app for your airline in the plane and it takes a selfie or you do a thumbprint or whatever, and that's linked to your RFID chip in your passport, such that when you get on the ground, you do the sort of the Dubai walkthrough aquarium thing where you look at all the pictures and, you know, all the fishies swimming around you. And behind that light tunnel are tons of cameras making sure they get your facial recognition correct. And then you come out the other end and you've cleared, right? And so can you speed some of those processes up? I think we are going to see sort of an acceleration on that development and that investment more than some of the other areas.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we're going to have a lot of development of things like the US Mobile Passport Program, which is the sort of global entry without the global entry kind of situation. I think that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think that the industry's technology level is certainly at a place where we should be able to do all this, right? None of this is untried and untested tech at this point. You know, I think that the governments who've engaged with Apple and Google on their sort of COVID safe style apps are much more likely to be able to also engage with Apple and Google on this. And I think that's certainly an opportunity for some of those technology integrators in the ecosystem to get into.
Yeah, the technology I almost would argue is the easy part. It's the physical bits that's going to be much more challenging, you know. Yeah. Exactly. How do you move the bags fast enough from the plane out to baggage claim? Does it switch to the full delivery model now, where you entice people to pick the pickup option or drop off option, where they drop their bags, you know, at the car park at departure, and it shows up in their hotel room at arrival, and you don't touch it in between?
Yeah, the Japan model, it works incredibly well there, and it's one of the things I wish was everywhere in the world. Absolutely. Yeah.
There is a question that occurs to me as you describe this, though. If you are going to do something like that, you're putting your goods, your stuff, in the hands of people you don't know, which means that at some stage, when you drop off your bag, is it clean or is it not clean? When it arrives in your hotel, is it clean or is it not clean? Do you have to wipe everything down? It speaks to the whole thing about emergency measures in the whole travel funnel, if you like. It's awful. How does this work? The system is designed to move people quickly, cheaply, economically, and now you've got this whole other filter that covers everything. How do you do this?
Very poorly.
Yeah. I think this goes back to our point that we're not going to see fundamental change, because it's just none of the infrastructure, none of the basic understandings of this, one of the world's largest industries, can be physically changed in that way, right?
Yeah, and I want to take a half step back from nothing is ever going to change to nothing's changing quickly. And so some of these things will happen. We are going, you know, we've seen the biometrics stuff start already with, you mm-hmm. know, that you get the face scan for your boarding and it verifies against your passport that you scan somewhere else. Right, so that the gate agent doesn't have to look at your passport to get you on board a plane now at a bunch of airports in the U.S. That sort of thing.
Mask.
Yeah. Well, and so part of that is adjusting it so that the biometrics works just on eyes and not with the nose. So who the heck knows if that's going to actually come to fruition? But also, you know, removing touch points. That stuff is happening. There will be some investment there, but very little of it is happening quickly.
And I think, but by quickly, I think that means before there's a vaccine, right? Yeah. And I think that fundamentally, very few industries are going to be able to adapt to the pre-vaccine world, right?
Yeah.
Then, like, very few people are going to want to turn on that small, and indeed that unknown a dime,
yeah. Right? No, and it's 18 months, even, you know, if someone said there's a vaccine tomorrow, it's still 18 months before we figure out what that really means in terms of distribution, production, number of people. Does it really work? Does the virus mutate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're looking at the end of 2021, I guess. So 18 months from now, any of these changes, I think, have a material impact on the industry, and that's getting them rolled out in volume. So it's, we got a long runway ahead of us.
That brings us to the next item here, the whole idea of trends, right? Where we are today, this industry took decades to get us to where we are. That is a very powerful tsunami trend in travel. You know, the famous traffic doubles every 15 years. It's always been that way. Now we've hit this counter tsunami, and we're talking about the technology trends. We're talking about, you know, people being used to paying a certain price point for travel. There's a certain assumed demand for travel. We're going into it right now in the summer. We all would love to get away from 2020 in any way we can, but we're kind of stuck here. You know, the idea of acceleration in trends, but we've got a lot of conflicting trends now. How do we manage that?
Seth, do you want to keep that one off?
Very poorly. I seem to be a bit of a broken record on some of these answers. No, it's, you know, the trends, there's good trends and there's bad trends. And so, you know, alluding back to the biometric stuff we're just discussing, I think, you know, that's a trend that is going to accelerate and we'll see more usage of, and it's going to be good for the industry. Questionable about privacy and some other challenges there, but overall good for the industry. And most passengers, I think, you know, share out too much of their lives anyway, so they won't care. So here you go. But beyond that, you know, some of the other trends in terms of, you know, low fares, of cramming more and more seats into the same space on an airplane, or, you know, thinner seats, all those things. I think that those trends continue. You know, this isn't necessarily a retrenchment so much as a pause in my mind. And yes, the numbers are going to go down, obviously, and then they'll come back. But it's going to look more like, in, you know, if we zoom out 20 years or whatever and look at, back at ourselves when we're retired and enjoying ourselves much more, this is going to look more like a blip than a complete shift in the trend. It's a big blip, though, right? Much more than 2008, much more than 2001 to 2003, significantly larger than all of those things. But I do think it's not a dramatic, you know, sort of shift in where the trends are going, just a delay in how they're getting implemented.
And I think that also, I mean, one of the things you were talking about, Alison, is the idea that the prices that we had before were a sustainable situation. And I mean that both in the capital S and lowercase s situation. Certainly here in Europe, you know, you've seen governments in their bailouts start putting, you know, things in place that mean that some of the worst polluting parts of the industry just don't get to operate anymore, right?
Yeah.
And I think that will certainly continue. I think that we're going to see, you know, I think the industry has a real opportunity to retire it off to its older, more gas-guzzling aircraft, right? And I think that we're seeing that starting already. You know, RIP, my favorite aircraft, the A340-600, of course. But I think this is going to be something that the industry really does have an opportunity to start looking at. I think that there is, this is not the only crisis we're ever going to see. It's probably not the only crisis we're going to see this decade. And if the industry can be in a point where it is, I want to say, best prepared for rainy days, I think that would be a very good thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree that there probably be future crises. I hope none of them are nearly this big. This is far more than a rainy day, I think, in a lot of ways. So that's a challenge to look at. But to your point about the environmental impact, you know, yes, there are a few good bits of news out of that, France and Austria specifically. ICAO, however, decided to drop 2020 numbers from the Corsia plan. So they're going to now use 2019 as the baseline rather than 2020, because 2020 was such a abnormal year, which, good news, bad news there, I would argue, right? If 2020 was a normal year, 2020 would have been probably higher than 2019. So at least 2019 numbers are better than nothing. But as the baseline, if you started with the current 2020 numbers and total emissions, it would have been impossible to comply given what the technology that exists today. So doesn't mean they shouldn't have strived for that, but it is a little disappointing to see a walk back there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think that there are a lot of wider things for the industry to be looking at in terms of through ticketing with trains, in terms of, you know, just making sure that people are going to have options. Yeah. You know, I think that as ever, aviation is subject to externalities. This is going to be one of those sets of externalities that is absolutely going to be happening to it.
Yeah. As an American, I'm forced to ask, what are trains?
Right. They're like buses with special little roads.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, to come back to the whole thing about cabin, there's obviously, there's this whole thing of managing space and onboard clarity of messaging from the industry to people, to consumers, to adjust expectations to what is going to be this new reality. Before we go to the Q&A for everybody in the audience, if you want to do a Q, if you have any questions, use the chat at the bottom, please. But in the meantime, gentlemen, let's talk about managing space and how the airline industry is supposed to message these expectations to people.
Yeah. Well, I think we got into that a little bit when we talked about what Frontier was doing, right? I don't think we can be in a situation where people can be seem to be profiting off this part of the crisis. I think that you have to be very careful about the psychology of that. And and I think that we're going to see something similar once business class gets back in the sky, right? I can absolutely see we're going to have parts. I mean, look, travel budget's going to be slashed, but also there's a point at which, in the same way that you want your executive to be well rested, you also want your executive to not catch this disease and be out of commission for weeks, months, / forever, right? Does that change the appeal of things like the Dord Suite business classes? How can airlines monetize that and merchandise that successfully, right? Let's say you're Delta, right? And you're flying A350s, no more 777s, but A350s with the Delta One Suite, right? The Dord thing. But you've also got 767s with and A330s, I believe, without the doors. You're flying those alongside. How do you make sure that when you're selling someone the Dord product, they get the Dord product, right? How do you monitor that? That's something that airlines have by and large never guaranteed, right? You never guarantee that you're going to get product X versus product Y when you buy a business class ticket.
Yeah. Swiss is a good example. They charge extra for the throne seat, right? I mean, that's, but JetBlue, which has a similar in its mint cabin, never did. And so today JetBlue is blocking the adjacent seats in the doubles. So everybody gets a single row, but you know, which is great if you have to fly. Nice to do it if you can. But you know, if you're looking at those opportunities, you know, doing it again today, does, you know, Swiss still charge extra for the throne seat? Lufthansa was apparently going to do it with their 777X, which is now years away. But you know, again, it comes down to that: is there a value? Almost certainly, yes. Can the airlines extract that value and do it in a way that comes off as appropriate rather than money grabbing jerks? A little harder.
Yeah, I'm not sure they have a lot of game in this particular arena, in fairness. I think there are also there are real opportunities here, and a lot of them are around the off the plane experience. Right, I think you've got the options for. I mean, look, we jotted down in the notes the things like private car transfers, right? Whether that's to the aircraft or, you know, being picked up and then processed in a private facility or whatever, right? Things like fast track, right? You know, I've got friends coming to visit me from the UK here in France, and they decided to burn extra frequent flyer miles on business class, even though it's only, you know, an hour and a half flight. Simply because they wanted to have the fast track processing, right? Less time standing in queues, fewer snakes of the tensor barrier line. I think that people are going to be making those decisions. And there are, you know, everyone's going to have a different level of comfort with every single part of it. And if airlines are smart, and if airports are smart as well, they'll figure out how to do that without it feeling like, oh, well, if you can afford the extra, you know, 10 euros or whatever it is to use the what's the English for fast track, sorry, then you can do it, right? That can't be the acceptable face of this, you know?
C'est la route vite, oui, en français?
It's a coupe file. The cut the line, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. There's another challenge, though, and we've seen this in terms of sort of the TSA pre-check, the phenomenon where, okay, it's faster, you go through more quickly, but as more and more people got pre-check, those lines got longer and longer because the facilities didn't adjust their distribution of space for that sort of thing. And so, you know, when you have, if everybody wants to use, you know, the fast track, do you have the throughput to handle it? Do you need to suddenly redesign your physical space to make that work? That's also a real challenge for the industry.
Yeah. And of course, I think we can all have examples of where the fast track is always like three times longer than the slow track, right?
So. But I don't have to take my shoes off, so I still stay in that line.
Right.
It's true. I mean,
this really does emphasize it's going to be different because that's not a thing that most of us have to do in the rest of the world. Right? Like the benefits of having, in my home airport in Lyon, right? The benefits of fast track are basically not snaking around the queue two times. No big surprise that there are airlines that choose not to pay for that.
Similar here in the States with the paid services that we also have available.
Yeah, right. Clear. Yeah. Usually, yeah. But there's also like LAX private suites, which is truly a individualized experience. And obviously, it doesn't scale great, but if you're willing to pay $500 to $1,000, you have your own private waiting room, your own private TSA security check, and your own private car that drops you off at the bottom of the jet bridge, and you walk up and walk onto the plane. So,
yeah.
Or yeah. Vice versa, you can leave the airport in that manner. So, mm-hmm. There are some options, but, you know, is it a $10 thing? Is it a $100 thing? Is it a $1,000 thing? Every zero helps one way or another.
Is there any data that tells us about the proportion of travelers who will pay more, and what, has there been any research on that? If who will pay, what percentage will pay more, and what more they will pay?
And that's really hard because you can sort of ask people, would you pay $20 extra for X? And then you go and sell them a ticket and they still buy the $20 cheaper ticket, right? This is the problem of, oh, people would rather have Wi-Fi than lavatories on airplanes. But then they don't pay for the Wi-Fi. So even though they said they would, if you block middle seats forever, and I saw that came across as one of the questions in the chat, if you block middle seats forever, it's a 40% probably spike in fare. Will anybody pay for that? Yes, because we've already seen people pay for premium economy seats over economy at a similar premium, if not even a little higher, mostly long haul, though not short haul. Mostly, and it's a very limited number of people, right? If we go back to history and look at more room throughout coach, American Airlines tried to market on that for several years and ended up failing. Continental tried to market meals at mealtimes and had to give up on that because it wasn't driving the revenues. JetBlue might argue that they're still demanding a little extra yield for extra legroom on their planes relative to the others, but again, probably not enough to justify certainly blocking middle seats unless people are going to pay a significant premium there.
Yeah, I guess the counterpoint, of course, is that in the Australian market, like Jetstar exists, but so does Qantas.
Sure.
And Tiger exists and so does Virgin.
And Delta exists and so does Spirit. I mean, we can,
yeah,
there are different, but the question is, is it because of the route network? Is it because of the other things? Is it because of the space on board? And what are you actually paying the extra for, right? Are you paying extra because Delta's more reliable and you're more likely to actually get to your destination at or close to the time you booked your ticket for?
And whom are you flying with, of course?
Yeah.
Are you flying with Qantas people or are you flying with Jetstar people?
Well,
right? I mean, there's all sorts of wonderful Australian comedy about that, right? But no, to come back to your question about whether or not we've got numbers, I think that you could look at things like how many people buy the EasyJet speedy boarding package, right? You could look at things like how many people buy the things like Peach's space seat. Look at things like how many people are in the are enrolled in Global Entry, right? All of these things have some sort of merit, right? But I think you also, but they're very hard to take in isolation, right? Yeah. In the same way that, yes, there are a lot of people in Priority Pass lounges, but how many of those people have actually purchased Priority Pass, and how many of them have it because they have one of the credit cards with the metal card that gives you it as part of a wider package that you perhaps would not choose.
I wouldn't buy Priority Pass, but I get it through one of my cards that I get other value for. And so on the off chance I'm at one of those airports, sure, I'll duck in and grab a snack or something.
Yes. A lovely weaponized croissant, my favorite. But look, I think there is definitely a a proportion of the population that is willing to make those payments.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. It's just small. That's the problem. Yeah. It's very small.
Yeah. And we come back to our thing of there being no real fundamental change, right? As long as airlines are allowed to sit people in 17-inch blocks, they will do so, right? And if governments decide that's not a... Right. And if governments... And the basic price of aviation is in that sort of 17-inch by 29-inch block, right? And you can fiddle with it a bit on the edges and you have an 18-inch seat and a 30-inch pitch. But that's... That is very much fiddling around the edges, and I sort of hate myself for saying that because I'm a big fan of all that fiddling that's going on, but at the same time, it is fundamental that unless we see interventions from governments, unless we see it from regulators that say no, you can't do this, we're unlikely to see the airlines individually deciding that we can't do that, and then you end up with a position like we have now where airline X's medical advisors are saying, oh, middle seats. And airline Y's advisors are saying, no, middle seats, right? This isn't a sustainable or sensible situation to be in where the airlines don't agree on whether or not middle seats should be built.
Do you, either of you guys have, a sense of, at the moment, Delta and Southwest are making a thing about the middle, no middle seat being sold. On the other side, you have Americans saying, if there's a seat, we'll sell it. Is there any evidence of how this is impacting the traveling public in terms of behavior, people buying this or buying that?
Anecdotally, a very small bit, but I think more than anything else, we're still looking at a situation where people buy the seats that are, what they're, going where they need to go at the right price. There's a handful of people who will say, JetBlue is blocking seats, Southwest is blocking a seat, Delta is blocking a seat. I feel more comfortable that way. But a lot of people who are feeling that are also the ones who are like, yeah, but I don't actually feel comfortable on an airplane at all. So if I had to travel, maybe I would pick one of those and maybe I would even pay a little bit more. But probably not. And we honestly, I don't think we've really seen that there's a price premium on them yet either. That's the real challenge, right? Maybe people are saying, okay, I'm going to fly Delta because I can, and they're going to block that middle seat for me. But is Delta also able to charge 1, 5, 10, 40% extra to justify that? And I don't think, certainly not at the top end of the 40%, but I'm not even sure even at the lower bits that they can say that it's the seat blocking that's worth people are seeing as worth paying for.
We've been tracking the TSA daily count.
Yeah.
And our friends at Flight Radar have been giving us their daily count of domestic flights. Mm-hmm. And about 2 weeks ago, we had noticed that the average number of passengers per domestic flight in the US had hit 60. It was an amazing number because, it was down to 12 10 weeks before. Literally, yeah. I think the low point was 11 as an average. I mean, 11 people on a plane. That's incredible. Anyway, so then came the long weekend, the 4th of July, and it hit 65 going into the weekend and then 65 at the end of the weekend. And then last Friday, we went back to 48.
Yeah, and that's partly because the number of flights continues to increase. The airlines saw potential for, I don't know if you saw the Holly Hedgman interview with Ross.
Yes.
With Vasu. It's a great read, but it was like, it costs us nothing to operate these things. Our fuel is free essentially, and our employees are free. Why not go fly them and see if we can put some bodies in the seats? That worked until we had it worked until you had a spike in COVID rates again. And now we're seeing the rates drop. I mean, yesterday, Monday was week over week down about 8% on passenger count. And part of that's going to be skewed by the 4th of July holiday Monday that you're comparing against. But we're seeing the moving average of, 7-day moving average of total passengers ticked down a little bit as of yesterday. So, several airlines announced over the weekend that they're actually scaling back their July and August flight expansions because ticket purchases plateaued. People aren't buying as many tickets. And so we're scaling that back. Things are drawing back down.
I brought that up, Seth, because in terms of what you were saying about how much pricing power do the airlines have in terms of trying to figure out, if I'm Delta and Southwest and I'm going to give you a middle seat, you know, I'd like a few bucks more. But it would seem to me that the pricing power is nowhere near where where it needs to be for the industry. It's clearly people are voting with their feet and avoiding travel.
More often than not, that seat was empty anyways. So saying that you're blocking it does help. And we continue to see, you know, the pictures on Twitter of, you know, full airplanes and why is, you know, my plane so full? I hate you. Name airline here. Those are the exceptions, right? These days, the odds are when you get on board, there's going to be an empty seat next to you just based on the total passenger count. And so it doesn't make you feel any better when that doesn't turn out to be the case, but it's where we are as an industry. And so can an airline really derive extra revenue for promising that? A little bit of game theory, but probably not.
Well, we've seen Southwest in the last few weeks offer $39 and $49 fare sales. And haven't seen the price elasticity or Southwest effect that one normally would expect from that.
Yeah, no, I mean, Southwest is renowned for not running fare sales in the summers, and here we are.
Yeah, no, you're not going to get the demand stimulation effects at this point, right? Like, so I feel you've already simulated all the demand that you're going to get for this summer. And everyone else is going to drive or take the train or whatever, right? Even if they're insane enough to go to Disney World, right? You're going to drive there rather than fly. It's not great news, I don't think, but it is nonetheless more clear than I think it was even a few weeks ago. So clarity is always helpful.
Time-wise, we're coming up on a quarter of the hour here, so I think it's time to start some Q&A, Addison, if you're reading the chat. We've got some audience questions.
What Seth and John have been quite effectively is monitoring. There's been very few Q&As, but Seth particularly has been slipping those answers right in when a question popped in. So
you're welcome, sir. It's been my pleasure.
I feel the love.
But I think that's an interesting question from Nico there about global rules on COVID. Fundamentally, I think we do need some. I think ICAO should definitely have been more active on this than it has. And I think that it feels like the major regional regulators should really be getting their teeth into this at this point. You know, just to say, look, whatever it is they say, just make it a level playing field, right? Don't make public safety and public health commercial decisions for airlines. It's just a terrible idea, both for airlines and for public health, right?
You know, and it's been interesting to, you know, I've been following the IATA sort of weekly briefings that up until yesterday were running weekly for the last couple months. And they really were keen on the idea of, like, you know, we need cooperation. We need this coordination from regulators. And they were trying to get it, as you say, in a regional level at a, you know, any sort of cross-border thing that could happen and trying to coordinate some of that stuff. And there has been some agreement on what the sort of policies are going to be, but they're so weak and so vague that they haven't really delivered the coordination that we were hoping for.
Yeah, no, I agree. Call your elected representative now. To an extent, 'twas ever thus, and I don't think the industry is in a particularly new place there, right? There's always been that sort of, and certainly got in the last year and a half about the 737 MAX situation, right? We're all talking about this fragmenting of regulator alignment, right? Between that and, you know, Brexit with the UK CAA breaking off with, you know, essentially zero expertise in doing anything that a regulator needs to do, you're going to have situations where this is going to come up. And I'm not sure that IATA is the forum in which that has to be, but in which the airlines need to create their side of the equation, but it needs to be somewhere.
IATA is a lobbying industry group, right? We have to remember that. They don't represent passengers at all, and they don't represent anything but the airlines. And so,
and not all airlines.
Huh? And only some airlines.
And not all airlines, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a challenge there, definitely. But they're big, right? They have power. They've got a big microphone, megaphone.
Yeah.
What ICAO, should they be involved in the process?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are, as an organization. The challenge there, again, though, is ICAO is slow. I mean, it's just the nature of the sort of bureaucracy in which it operates. But it makes a decision eventually, and then that sort of disseminated out to the member countries. And over time, they implement. It's not like ICAO can say, hey, by the way, tomorrow all middle seats have to be blocked, and that would even work. They never are going to decide that. And even if they did, it probably wouldn't work, right? So,
Yeah. Even if they did, it would have to be adopted by EASA and the JAA and CASA and everyone's national or supranational regulator, right?
Sorry to jump in. So if we come back again to this, the whole idea of, we spent a lot of time talking about the whole funnel, and because at the very beginning we decided in the conversation that regarding the cabin, nothing's going to change. Okay, so I want to go back to that and say, well, wait a second. Airline economics is this thing, and then there is the market, and the twain need to meet for everybody to survive. If you need to travel, for example, living in North America, you cannot catch a train, it's too big. Nobody I know gets on the bus. So you have to travel and the twain have to meet. Sorry to repeat that, but how do we close that gap?
Medicine, science, and passengers conceding defeat. Or acceptance, maybe not defeat, but acceptance.
Right, and people just beginning to live with the fact that this is a risk, and that eventually everyone will have to just wear a damn mask and deal with the fact that they have to think about other people. This is apparently revolutionary to a certain proportion of the population, but it's.
I'm from the generation that when I grew up, nobody had peanut allergies. Nobody had the things that the kids have today. So
they did have some, they just died from it.
Well, yeah. Okay, but the gene,
right?
I don't want to be nasty to talk about cleaning the gene pool or anything, but we do have a nice question here from somebody. What, if any, bolt-on products or technologies may become the norm in the cabin through and post COVID?
This is interesting.
So go ahead, John.
So I think that we will see a lot more wireless ordering. Again, this is an acceleration of a trend, right? I was talking with Blue Box, who make one of those little Wi-Fi boxes that you pop in the overhead bins. They're already working with RAM to get, essentially, you pick up your phone, you say, I would like a ham sandwich and a Diet Coke, please. And that pings up in the galley and someone brings it to you, masked, gowned, and so on. I think we'll see a lot of that.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think, and this sort of ties into the next question that also just rolled in about a touchless cabin.
Right.
The other area where we're going to see a little more of that is going to be integration into the IFE system using your personal device as a remote control. Whether it's you can broadcast your content through the bigger screen, which comes with all sorts of DRM challenges, or just being able to use it to literally scroll through the list of movies far more efficiently than on the generally bad UI touchscreen of an economy class seat. Being able to do that, pick, switch channels, things like that. Those systems exist today. They are generally kludgy at best and terrible on average. But they exist. And so now the airline that has it can say, actually, you don't have to touch the screen that someone else touched. You can use your phone. And it's a terrible experience, but at least you didn't touch someone else's screen. Soon they'll be able to say, and it's actually not that terrible experience, or at least I hope they will. But those things, the example you gave, John, of the retail in motion and Blue Box is a lower cost.
It doesn't work with BlackBerries,
it does not work with BlackBerries. That's a lower cost challenge and easier implementation than retrofitting, you know, IFE system to add the remote control through the PED. So both possible. One will come more quickly, and that trends will move that way.
Right. Actually, I think that this whole thing of people being scared to touch the IFE screen is a bit of a red herring.
Agreed.
I'm not. I mean, really, we can't just do that. Also, like, fundamentally, I'm more about getting my phone out on the plane than I am about touching the screen. Right. Like, because the phone comes with me, then I'm gonna have to disinfect my phone. Right. Yeah. I feel that my ideal situation is actually that I put my phone in a plastic bag inside my carry on. And then I don't, you know, have to worry about the fact that it's got, you know, the plague on it when I get there.
Except it's also your boarding pass and your passport now and all of those other things. So
yeah. Yeah. But you know, I'm renowned for being the person who always gets one printed out at the airport. So yeah. These are competing trends, right? And that's some of the things that we've already talked about, right? Is that these are fundamentally things that do not necessarily work well together. Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see what happens.
What do you guys think about how we need to dress for air travel? Do you think gloves and masks continue? I
definitely think at least your second best tiara. I think that's going to be important. I think from what we know at this point, and I'm sort of reading some interesting stuff coming out of is it Massachusetts about the aerosolized spread of this thing. From what we know, a simple fabric mask or face covering, like whether that's a bandana or a scarf or whatever, is remarkably effective at protecting other people from you if you are potentially ill, right? Similarly, we are quite fortunate this is a coronavirus, not other forms of virus, the ones that can't be disrupted by alcohol hand gel, right? At this point, I think if we're armed with our masks and our Purell, I think that's kind of going to have to be where we are on this until we have a vaccine. Fundamentally, that's a trade-off we're going to have to make if we get on a plane.
Yeah, say that or at home.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that we are going to see there's going to be a different situation in terms of how and why we travel. I think that the good old proverbial trip to grandma's is going to become less sensible. I'm not necessarily sure that we want little Jimmy and little Susie to go and infect grandma this year. So, I think we may be seeing a change in that pattern. The extent to which that change affects people is going to be very interesting. At the same time, I think that we are also in the middle of something of a revolution in how we live our lives and how we structure our lives against work, right? I think that we're going to have a lot more people who are able to work from home. And that is inherently going to require more business travel, right? If you had all of your people in one city or you're a couple of cities, that's one situation. If you have them in 50 cities, that's a very different situation. And I think airlines need to be able to figure out how that's going to work. I think we're going to see a lot more of that acceleration in the trend of the modern independent business traveler, right? Whether that's someone who's working in the gig economy or not, people who are going to need to work while traveling. Right now, airlines are in general a bad place to try and get work done. That's especially true if the plane is an infection zone. So I'm fascinated by this. It's going to be really interesting, and it's going to require a lot of flexibility and adaptation from an industry that has not necessarily covered itself in glory in either of those two categories before. So I think ready for some innovation. I think
in terms of except that none of it's actually going to come to fruition. So.
I know
what you're saying. It's going to be a change in. Yeah. Process a change in behavior much more than a change in the stuff that we interact with.
Yeah. 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 And I think in the way that we structure our lives, right? And, you know, I certainly think that this year we're going to have the problem of, you know, when kids don't go back to school in September, like people are going to be like, well, I can't spend another 4 months homeschooling these kids. What the hell are we going to do with them? Right. Can we send them to someone? Right. Even if that ends up being grandma, you know, we're going to have to do something about this. And that's going to be its own special set of challenges. Right. Unaccompanied minors with masks right now. I'm not even sure if you can send a kid an unaccompanied minor at the moment. Right.
That scares me.
That is like, doesn't that start being like sort of fundamentally terrifying? You know, and this is all the kind of thing that aviation will have to figure out. Right.
Gentlemen, we are approaching the witching hour. So I want to, I know you guys would go all day and it's fascinating stuff, but I do need to hand it back to Ernie to start the wrap. Unless you have any last thoughts, Seth, I know that John's had a few last thoughts.
No, I truly do agree with most of what John said, which is sometimes rare, but we get there eventually. It's a brave new world. It's going to require a lot of behavioral changes, but ultimately I don't see enough changing in the actual cabin experience to drive those behavioral changes. It's going to have to be people making a risk assessment and deciding what's worth it to them.
Back to you, Ernie.
All right. All right. Am I muted, Addison?
No, we can hear you.
We can definitely hear your chair, Ernie.
I'm going to ship you a can of WD-40.
Yes, I think my chair is now gone. The new one is on the way, but we're waiting for Amazon. Before we go, thank you. Thanks to our panelists, a great panel today. Talking a little bit about Air Insight, what we do. We do strategy, market research, competitive intelligence, independent forecasting, market projections, data models and analysis. The reasons why you should hire us are on the right side, and we're always available for no obligation discussions. Give us a call if you're interested in special projects or have some needs. Next week, we're going to have a webinar on business aviation during COVID. Discussion on the state of the industry. We've got Brian Foley from Brian Foley and Associates, Paul Carrarelli, VP at JetNet, and Travis Kuhn from Argus Aero. So we'll have some interesting comments on the business aviation market, which seems to have bounced back much more rapidly than the airline market. Those who can't afford business jets are going to fly them, and they don't have many of the problems we've been discussing today. So that part of the market will likely come back sooner. And with that, I want to thank you all for attending today, and we'll take it from there.
Thanks, everybody.